could shoot well. As a result, he turned in the 10mm ammunition and swapped it for two boxes of 45 ACP, U.S.-made Federal HydroShock premium ammo, with a huge hollow point in which one could nearly mix a drink, or so it seemed when you looked into them. Lieutenant Colonel Malloy and his flight crew, Lieutenant Harrison and Sergeant Nance, walked in just as Team 2 started. They were armed with the standard American military-issue Beretta M9, and fired full-metal jacket 9mm rounds as required by the Hague Convention. America had never signed the international treaty detailing what was proper and what was not on the battlefield, but America lived by the rules anyway. The special operations people of Rainbow used different, more effective ammo, on the principle that they were not on a battlefield, but were rather engaging criminals who did not merit the solicitude accorded better organized and uniformed enemies. Anyone who thought about the issue found it slightly mad, but they knew that there was no hard and fast rule requiring the world to make sense, and shot the rounds they were issued. In the case of the Rainbow Troopers, it was no less than 100 rounds per day. Malloy and his crew got to shoot perhaps 50 rounds per week, but they weren't supposed to be shooters, and their presence here was merely a matter of courtesy. As it happened, Malloy was an excellent shot, though he fired his pistol one-handed in the manner once taught by the U.S. military. Harrison and Nance used the more modern Weaver stance, both hands on the weapons. Malloy also missed the 45 of his youth, but the American armed services had gone to the smaller diameter round to make the NATO countries happy, even though it made much smaller holes in the people whom you were supposed to shoot. The girl was named Fiona. She was just about to turn 5 years old and had fallen off a swing at her daycare center. The wood chips there had scratched her skin, but it was also feared that she might have broken the radius in her left forearm. Sandy Clark held the arm while the child cried. Very slowly and carefully she manipulated it, and the intensity of the child's tears didn't change. This wasn't broken. Well, possibly a very minor green stick fracture, but probably not even that. "Let's get an X-ray," Patsy said, handing over a grape sucker to the kid. It worked as well in England as it did in America. The tears stopped as she used her good right arm and teeth to rip off the plastic, then stuck the thing into her cute little mouth. Sandy used wetted gauze to clean off the arm. No need for stitches, just a few nasty scrapes that she'd paint with antiseptic and cover with two large band-aids. This ER wasn't as busy as its American counterparts. For one thing, it was in the country, and there was less opportunity for a major injury. They'd had a farmer the previous week who'd come close to ripping his arm off with a farm implement, but Sandy and Patsy had been off duty then. There were fewer severe auto accidents than in a comparable American area, because the Brits, despite their narrow roads and looser speed limits, seemed to drive more safely than Americans, a fact that had both of the American medics scratching their heads. All in all, duty here was fairly civilized. The hospital was overstaffed by American standards, and that made everyone's workload on the easy side of reasonable, somewhat to the surprise of both Americans. 10 minutes later, Patsy looked over the X-ray and saw that the bones of Fiona's forearm were just fine. 30 minutes after that, she was on her way back to daycare, where it was time for lunch. Patsy sat down at her desk and went back to reading the latest issue of The Lancet, while her mother returned to her stand-up desk and chatted with a colleague. Both perversely wished for more work to do, though that meant pain for someone they didn't know. Sandy Clark remarked to her English friend that she hadn't seen a gunshot wound in her whole time in England. In her Williamsburg, Virginia hospital, they'd been almost a daily occurrence, a fact that somewhat horrified her colleagues, but was just part of the landscape for an American ER nurse. Hereford wasn't exactly a sleepy community, but the vehicular traffic didn't make it a bustling metropolis either. Grady was in his rented car following the trucks to the objective, and going more slowly than usual, here in the far left lane, because he'd anticipated thicker traffic and therefore a longer trip in terms of time. He could have moved off at a faster clip and therefore started the mission earlier. But he was a methodical sort, and once his plan was drafted, he tended to stick to it almost slavishly. That way everyone knew what had to happen and when, which made operational sense. For the unexpected, every team member carried a cellular phone with speed dial settings for every other member. Sean figured they were almost as good as the tactical radios the soldiers carried. There was the hospital. It sat at the bottom of a shallow slope. The parking lot didn't seem to be very crowded. Maybe there weren't many patients in their beds. Or maybe the visitors were off having lunch before coming back to see their loved ones. Dimitri pulled his rental car over to the side of the through road and stopped. He was half a kilometer or so from the hospital. And from the top of this hill, he could see two sides, the front and the side entrance for the hospital's emergency room. He switched the motor off after lowering the power windows and waited to see what would happen next. On the back seat, he had an inexpensive set of 7x35 binoculars purchased at an airport shop, and he decided to get them out. Next to him on the seat was his cellular phone, should he need it. He saw three heavy trucks pull up and stop close to the hospital in positions far nearer than his, but, like his spot, able to cover the front and the emergency side entrance. It was then that Popov had a random thought. Why not call that Clark fellow at Hereford and warn him of what was to happen? He, Popov, didn't want these people to survive the afternoon, did he? If they didn't, then he'd have that $5 million-plus American dollars, and then he could disappear from the face of the earth. The islands of the Caribbean appealed to him. He'd gone over some travel brochures. They'd have some British amenities. Honest police, pubs, cordial people, plus a quiet, unhurried life, yet were close enough to America that he could travel there to manage his funds in whatever investment scheme he opted for. But no. There was the off chance that Grady would get away from this one, and he didn't want to risk being hunted by that intense and vicious Irishman. No, it was better that he let this play out without his interference. And so he sat in the car, binoculars in his lap, listening to classical music on one of the regular BBC radio stations. Grady got out of his Jaguar. He opened the boot, withdrew his parcel, and pocketed the keys. Timothy O'Neill dismounted his vehicle. He'd chosen a small van, and stood still, waiting for the other five men to join him. This they did after a few minutes. Timmy lifted his cell phone and thumbed the #1 speed dial setting. 100 yards away, Grady's phone started chirping.
"Yes?"
"We are ready here, Sean."
"Go on, then. We're ready here as well. Good luck, lad."
"Very well, we are moving in now."
O'Neill was wearing the brown coveralls of a package deliveryman. He walked toward the hospital's side entrance, carrying a large cardboard box, followed by four other men in civilian clothes carrying boxes similar in size, but not in color. Popov looked into his rearview mirror in annoyance. A police car was pulling over to the side of the road, and a few seconds later, a constable got out and walked to his car.
"Having a problem, sir?" the cop asked.
"Oh, no, not really. That is, I called the rental company, and they're sending someone out, you see."
"What went wrong?" the policeman asked.
"Not sure. The motor started running badly, and I thought it a good idea to pull over and shut it off. Anyway," the Russian repeated, "I called into the company, and they're sending someone to sort it out."
"Ah, very good, then." The police constable stretched, and it seemed as though he'd pulled over as much to get some fresh air as to render assistance to a stranded motorist. The timing, Popoff thought, could have been better.
"Can I help you?" the desk clerk said.
"I have a delivery for Dr. Chavez and nurse." He looked down at the slip of paper on the box, which seemed to him a clever bit of acting.
"Clark, are they in this afternoon?" Timmy O'Neill asked.
"I'll fetch them," the clerk said helpfully, heading back into the work area. The IRA soldier's hand slid along the inside of the lid, ready to flip the box open. He turned and nodded to the other four, who waited politely in line behind him. O'Neill thumbed his nose, and one of them—his name was Jimmy Carr—walked back outside. There was a police car there, a Range Rover, white with an orange stripe down the side. The policeman inside was eating a sandwich, taking lunch at a convenient place, in what American cops sometimes called cooping, just killing time when nothing was going on. He saw the man standing outside the casualty receive entrance holding what looked like a flower box. Several others had just gone inside holding similar boxes. But this was a hospital, and people gave flowers to those inside of them. Even so, the man with the large white box was staring at his police automobile, as people often did. The cop looked back at him, mainly in curiosity, though his cop instincts were beginning to light up.
"I'm Dr. Chavez," Patsy said.
She was almost as tall as he was, O'Neill saw, and very pregnant beneath her starched white lab coat.
"You have something for me?"
"Yes, doctor, I do." Then another woman approached, and the resemblance was striking from the first moment he saw the two of them. They had to be mother and daughter, and that meant that it was time. O'Neill flipped the top off the box and instantly extracted the AKMS rifle. He was looking down at it and missed the wide-eyed shock on the faces of the two women in front of him. His right hand withdrew one of the magazines and slapped it home into the weapon. Then he changed hands and let his right hand take hold of the pistol grip while his left slapped the bolt back into the battery position. The entire exercise hadn't lasted 2 seconds. Patsy and Sandy froze, as people usually did when suddenly confronted with weapons. Their eyes were wide and faces shocked. To their left, someone screamed. Behind this deliveryman, three others now held identical weapons and faced outward, aiming at the others in the reception area, and a routine day in the emergency room changed to something very different. Outside, Carr popped open his box, smiling as he aimed it at the police car only 20 feet away. The engine was running, and the cop's first instinct was to get clear and report in. His left hand slipped the selector into reverse, and his foot slammed down on the accelerator, causing the car to jolt backward. Carr's response was automatic. The weapon up, bolt back, he aimed and pulled the trigger, firing 15 rounds into the automobile's windscreen. The result was immediate. The Rover had been moving backward in a fairly straight line, but the moment the bullet started hitting, it swerved right, and ended up against the brick wall of the hospital. There it stopped, the pressure off the accelerator now. Carr sprinted over and looked inside to see that there was one less police constable in the world, and that to him was no great loss.
"What's that?"
It was the helpful roadside cop rather than Popoff who asked the rhetorical question. It was rhetorical because automatic weapons fire is not something to be mistaken for anything else. His head turned and he saw the police car, an identical twin to his own, scream backward, then stop, and then a man walked up to it, looked, and walked away.
"Bloody hell!"
Dmitri Arkadyevich sat still,
now watching the cop who'd come to his unneeded assistance. The man ran back to his vehicle, reached inside, and pulled out a radio microphone. Popoff couldn't hear what was said, but then he didn't need to.
"We've got them, Sean," O'Neill's voice told him.
Grady acknowledged the information, thumbed the end button, and speed-dialed Peter Barry's cell phone.
"Yes, Timothy has them. The situation appears to be under control."
"Okay." And this call ended.
Then Sean speed-dialed yet another number.
"Hello, this is Patrick Casey. We have seized the Hereford Community Hospital. We are currently holding as hostages Dr. Sanchez and Nurse Clark, plus numerous others. We will release our hostages if our demands are met. If they are not met, then it will be necessary for us to kill hostages until such time as you see the error of your ways. We require the release of all political prisoners held in Albany and Parkhurst prisons on the Isle of Wight. When they are released and seen to be released on the television, we will leave this area. Do you understand?"
"Yes, I understand," the desk sergeant replied.
He didn't, but he had a tape of this call, and he'd forward the information to someone who would understand. Carr took the casualty receiving entrance. The Barry twins, Peter and Sam, walked through the inside of the building to the main entrance. Here things were somewhat chaotic. Carr's initial fusillade hadn't been heard clearly here, and most of the people had turned their heads to the rough direction of the noise, and on seeing nothing, had turned back to attend to their business. The hospital's security guard, a man of 55 who was wearing something that looked like a police uniform, was heading for the door into the hospital proper when he saw the twins coming toward him with weapons in hand. The retired policeman managed to say, "What's all this?" The usual words of a British constable, before a jerk of one rifle muzzle convinced him to raise his hands and shut up. Sam grabbed his collar and shoved him back into the main lobby. There people saw the weapons. Some screamed. A few made for the doors, and all of them got outside without being fired upon, since the Barry twins had enough to do already. The police constable's radio call from the side of the road generated a greater response than Grady's phone call, especially with the report that a constable had been shot and probably killed in his car. The first reaction of the local superintendent was to summon all of his mobile units to the general area of the hospital. Only about half of them had firearms, and those were mainly Smith & Wesson revolvers, not nearly enough to deal with the reported use of machine guns. The death of the constable was established when an officer who had been parked near the hospital failed to report in, despite numerous calls over the police radio. Every police station in the world has preset responses for various emergencies. This one had a folder labeled Terrorism, and the superintendent pulled it out, even though he had the contents memorized, just to make sure he didn't forget anything. The top emergency number went to a desk in the home office, and he reported what little he knew to the senior civil servant there, adding that he was working to get more information and would report back. The home office headquarters building, close to Buckingham Palace, housed the bureaucrats who had oversight over nearly every aspect of life in the British Isles. That included law enforcement, and in that building, too, was a procedures folder, which was pulled from its slot. In this one was a new page and a new number. 4233, Alice Forgate said, on picking up the phone. This was the line used exclusively for important voice traffic.
"Mr. Clark, please."
"Yes. Wait, please."
"Mr. Clark, a call on 33," she said into the intercom.
"This is John Clark," Rainbow Six said, lifting the receiver.
"This is Frederick Calloway at the Home Office. We have a possible emergency situation," the civil servant said.
"Okay, where is it?"
Just up the road from you, I'm afraid, the Hereford Hospital. The voice which called in identified itself as Patrick Casey. That is a code name that the PIRA used to designate their operations.
Hereford Hospital? John asked, his hand suddenly cold on the phone.
That is correct.
Hold for a second. I want to get one of my people on this line. John put his hand over the receiver. Alice, get Alastair on this one right now.
Yes, John.
Mr. Calloway, this is Alastair Stanley, my second in command. Please repeat what you just told me.
He did so, then added, The voice identified two hostages by name, a nurse Clark and a Dr. Chavez.
Oh, shit, John breathed. I'll get Peter's team moving, John, Stanley said.
Right. Anything else, Mr. Calloway?
That is all we have now. The local police superintendent is attempting to gather more information at this time.
Okay, thank you. You can reach me at this number if you need me.
Clark replaced the receiver in its cradle.
Fuck, he said quietly.
His mind was racing. Whoever had scouted out Rainbow had done so for a reason, and those two names had not been an accident. This was a direct challenge to him and his people, and they were using his wife and daughter as a weapon. His next thought was that he would have to pass command over to Al Stanley, and the next, that his wife and daughter were in mortal danger. And he was helpless.
Christ! Major Peter Covington muttered over his phone.
Yes, sir. Let me get moving here. He stood and walked into his squad bay. Attention, we have some business. Everyone get ready to move immediately. Team One's members stood and headed to their lockers. It didn't seem like a drill, but they handled it as though it were. Master Chief Mike Chin was the first to be suited up. He came to see his boss, who was just putting on his body armor.
What gives, Skipper?
PIRA, local hospital, holding Clark's and Ding's wives as hostages.
What's that?
Chin asked, blinking his eyes hard.
You heard me, Mike.
Oh, shit.
Okay.
Chin went back into the squad bay.
Saddle up, people. This ain't no fucking drill.
Malloy had just sprinted to his Nighthawk. Sergeant Nant was already there, pulling red-flagged safety pins from their plug points and holding them up for the pilot to confirm the count.
Looking good. Let's start her up, Lieutenant.
Turning one, Harrison confirmed, as Sergeant Nance reboarded the aircraft and strapped on his move-around safety belt, then shifted to the left side door to check the tail of the Nighthawk.
Tail rotor is clear, Colonel.
Malloy acknowledged that information as he watched his engine instrument spooling up. Then he keyed his radio again.
Command, this is Bear. We are turning and burning. What do you want us to do? Over.
Bear, this is Five. Stanley's voice came back, to Malloy's surprise. Lift off and orbit the local hospital. That is the site of the current incident.
Say again, Five. Over.
Bear, we have subjects holding the local hospital. They are holding Mrs. Clark and Mrs. Chavez as hostages. They've identified both of them by name. Your orders are to lift off and orbit the hospital.
Roger, copy that. Bear is lifting off now.
His left hand pulled the collective, climbing the Sikorsky into the sky.
Did I hear that right, Colonel? Harrison asked.
You must have.
Fuck, the Marine observed.
Somebody was grabbing the tiger by the balls, Malloy thought. He looked down to see a pair of trucks speeding off the base, heading in the same direction as he. That would be Covington and Team One, he thought. With a little more reflection, he took the Nighthawk to 4,000 feet, called the local air traffic control center to tell them what he was doing, and got a transponder code so that they could track him properly. There were 4 police vehicles there now, blocking the access to the hospital parking lots, but doing nothing else, Popoff saw through his binoculars. The constables inside were just looking, all standing outside their cars, 2 of them holding revolvers, but not pointing them at anything but the ground.
In one truck, Covington relayed the information he had. In the other, Chin did it. The troopers were as shocked as they had ever allowed themselves to be, having considered themselves and their families to be ipso facto immune to this sort of thing, because nobody had ever been foolish enough to try something like this. You might walk up to a lion cage and prod him with a stick, but not when there weren't any bars between you and him. And you never ever messed with the lion's cubs, did you? Not if you wanted to be alive at sundown. This was family for all of them. Attacking the wife of the Rainbow Commander was a slap in all their faces, an act of incomprehensible arrogance. And Chavez's wife was pregnant. She represented two innocent lives, both of them belonging to one of the people with whom they exercised every morning and with whom they had the occasional pint in the evening, a fellow soldier, one of their team. They all flipped on their radios and sat back, holding their individual weapons, allowing their thoughts to wander, but not very far. "Al, I have to let you run this operation," John said, standing by his desk and preparing to leave. Dr. Bellow was in the room along with Bill Tawney.
"I understand, John. You know how good Peter and his team are?"
A long breath.
"Yeah."
There wasn't much of anything else to say right then. Stanley turned to the others.
"Bill?"
"They used the right code name. Patrick Casey is not known to the press. It's a name they use to let us know that their operation is real, usually used with bomb threats and such. Paul?"
"Identifying your wife and daughter is a direct challenge to us. They're telling us that they know about Rainbow, that they know who we are, and, of course, who you are, John. They're announcing their expertise and their willingness to go all the way."
The psychiatrist shook his head.
"But if they're really PIRA, that means they're Catholic. I can work on that. Let's get me out there and establish contact, shall we?"
Tim Noonan was already in his personal car, his tactical gear in the back. At least this was easy for him. There were two cell phone nodes in the Hereford area, and he'd been to both of them while experimenting with his lockout software. He drove to the farther of the two first. It was a fairly typical setup, the usual candelabra tower standing in a fenced enclosure with a truck-type trailer. Called a caravan over here, he remembered. A car was parked just outside. Noonan pulled alongside and hopped out without bothering to lock it up. 10 seconds later, he pulled open the door to the caravan.
"What's this?" the technician inside asked.
"I'm from Hereford. We're taking this cell offline right now."
"Says who?"
"Says me." Noonan turned so that the guy could see the holstered pistol on his hip. "Call your boss. He knows who I am and what I do." And with no further talk, Noonan walked to the master-powered panel and flipped the breaker, killing transmissions from the tower. Then he sat in front of the computer control system and inserted the floppy disk he'd carried in his shirt pocket. 2 mouse clicks, and 40 seconds later the system was modified. Only a number with a 777 prefix would be accepted now. The technician didn't have a clue, but did have the good sense not to dispute the matter with a man carrying a gun.
"Anybody at the other one? On the other side of town?" Noonan asked.
"No, that would be me if there's a problem. But there isn't."
"Keys."
Noonan held his hand out.
"I can't do that. I mean, I do not have authorization to—"
"Call your boss right now," the FBI agent suggested, handing him the landline receiver. Covington jumped out of the truck near where some commercial trucks were parked. The police had established a perimeter to keep the curious at bay. He trotted over to what appeared to be the senior cop at the site.
"There they are," Sean Grady said over his phone to Timmy O'Neill.
"Sure, and they responded quickly. Ever so formidable they look," he added.
"How are things inside?"
"Too many people for us to control properly, Sean. I have the twins in the main lobby, Jimmy here with me, and Daniel is patrolling upstairs."
"What of your hostages?"
"The women, you mean.
They're sitting on the floor. The young one is very pregnant, Sean. She could have it today, looks like.
Try to avoid that, lad, Grady advised, with a smile. Things were going according to his plan, and the clock was running. The bloody soldiers had even parked their trucks within 20 meters of his own. It could scarcely have been better.
Houston's first name wasn't really Sam. His mother had named him Mortimer, after a favored uncle. But the current moniker had been laid on him during boot camp at Fort Jackson, South Carolina, 11 years before, and he hadn't objected. His sniper rifle was still in its boxy carrying case to safeguard it from shock, and he was looking around for a good perch. Where he was standing wasn't bad, the sergeant thought. He was ready for whatever the day offered. His rifle was a virtual twin to that used by his friend Homer Johnston, and his marksmanship was just as good, too. A little better, he'd quickly tell anyone who asked. The same was true of Rifle 1-2, Sergeant First Class Fred Franklin, formerly an instructor at the Army's Marksmanship Training Unit at Fort Benning, and a deadly shot out to a mile with his huge Macmillan 50-bolt action rifle.
"What do you think, Sam?" "I like it here, Freddy. How about you go to that knoll past the helipad?" "Looks good to me. Later."
Franklin hoisted the case onto his shoulder and headed off that way.
"Those people scare me," Roddy Sands admitted over the phone.
"I know, but one of them is close enough to take out at once, Roddy. You take that job, lad."
"I will, Sean," Sands agreed from inside the cargo area of the big Volvo truck.
Noonan, now with the keys to the other site, was back in his car and heading that way. The drive would take 20 minutes. No, more, he realized. Traffic was backing up on this A-class road, and though he had a gun on his hip, and even police identification, his car didn't have a siren and gumball machine. An oversight he himself had never considered, to his sudden and immediate rage. How the fuck had they forgotten that? He was a cop, wasn't he? He pulled to the shoulder, turned on his emergency flashers, and started leaning on the horn as he sped past the stopped cars. Chavez didn't react much. Instead of looking angry or fearful, he just turned inward on himself. A small man, his body seemed to shrink even further before Clark's eyes. "Okay," he said finally, his mouth dry. "What are we doing about it?" "Team One is there now, or should be. Al is running the operation. We're spectators. Head over." Clark wavered, which was unusual for him. The best thing to do, one part of his mind told him quietly, was to sit still, stay in his office and wait, rather than drive over and torture himself with knowledge that he couldn't do anything about. His decision to let Stanley run the operation was the correct one. He couldn't allow his actions to be affected by personal emotions. There were more lives at stake than his wife's and daughter's, and Stanley was a pro who'd do the right thing without being told. On the other hand, to stay here and simply listen to a phone or radio account was far worse. So he walked back to his desk, opened a drawer, and took out his Beretta 45 automatic. This he clipped to his belt at his right hip. Chavez, he saw, had his sidearm as well. "Let's go." "Wait." Chavez lifted Clark's desk phone and called the Team 2 building.
"Sergeant Major Price," the voice answered.
"Eddie, this is Ding. John and I are going to drive over there. You're in command of Team 2.
"Yes, sir, I understand. Major Covington and his lads are as good as we are, sir, and Team 2 is suited up and ready to deploy."
"Okay, I have my radio with me."
"Good luck, sir."
"Thanks, Eddie." Chavez hung up. "Let's get going, John." For this ride, Clark had a driver, but he had the same problem with traffic that Noonan was having, and adopted the same solution, speeding down the hard shoulder with his horn blowing and lights blinking. What should have been a 10-minute drive turned into double that.
Who is this?
This is Superintendent Fergus MacLeish, the cop on the other end of the phone circuit responded. And you are?
Patrick Casey will do for now, Grady answered smugly. Have you spoken with the Home Office yet?
Yes, Mr. Casey, I have.
MacLeish looked at Stanley and Bellow as he stood at his command post, half a mile from the hospital, and listened to the speakerphone.
When will they release the prisoners, as we demanded?
Mr. Casey, most of the senior people are out of the office having lunch at the moment. Mainly the chaps in London I spoke to are trying to attract them down and get them into the office. I haven't spoken with anyone in a position of authority yet, you see.
I suggest that you tell London to get them in quickly. I am not by nature a patient man.
I need your assurance that no one has been hurt, MacLeish tried next.
Except for one of your constables, no, no one has been hurt yet. That will change if you take action against us, and it will also change if you and your friends in London make us wait too long, do you understand?
Yes, sir. I do understand what you just said.
You have 2 hours until we begin eliminating hostages. We have a goodly supply, you know.
You understand, if you injure a hostage, that will change matters greatly, Mr. Casey. My ability to negotiate on your behalf will be greatly reduced if you cross that line.
That is your problem, not mine, was the cold reply. I have over 100 people here, including the wife and daughter of your chief counter-terrorist official. They will be the first to suffer for your inaction. You now have 1 hour and 58 minutes to begin the release of every political prisoner in Albany and Parkhurst prisons. I suggest you get moving on that immediately. Goodbye.
And the line went dead.
He's talking tough, Dr. Bellow observed. Sounds like a mature voice in his 40s, and he's confirmed that he knows who Mrs. Clark and Dr. Chavez are. We're up against a professional, and one with unusually good intelligence. Where could he have gotten it? Bill Tawney looked down at the ground.
Unknown, Doctor. We had indications that people were looking into our existence, but this is disquieting.
Okay, next time he calls, I talk to him, Bellow said. I'll see if I can calm him down some.
Peter, this is Stanley, Rainbow Five called over his tactical radio.
Covington here.
What have you done to this point?
I have both riflemen deployed for overwatch and intelligence gathering, but I'm keeping the rest close. I'm waiting now for a building diagram. We have as yet no firm estimate of the number of subjects or hostages inside.
The voice hesitated before going on.
I recommend that we consider bringing Team 2 in. That is a large building to cover with only 8 men, should we have to move in.
Stanley nodded.
Very well, Peter. I will make the call.
How are we looking on gas? Malloy asked, looking down as he orbited the hospital.
A good 3.5 hours, Colonel, Lieutenant Harrison answered.
Malloy turned to look into the cargo bay area of the Nighthawk. Sergeant Nance had the zipline ropes out and hooked into the eye bolts on the floor of the aircraft. That work done, he sat in the jump seat between and behind the pilot, co-pilot seats, his pistol clearly visible in his shoulder holster, listening in on the tactical radio like everyone else.
"Well, we're going to be here for a while," the Marine said.
"Sir, what do you think about—"
"I think I don't like it at all, Lieutenant. Aside from that, we're better off not thinking very much."
And that was a bullshit answer, as everyone aboard the Nighthawk knew.
You might as well tell the world to stop turning as to tell men in this situation to stop thinking. Malloy was looking down at the hospital, figuring approach angles for a long wire or zip line deployment. It didn't appear all that difficult to accomplish, should it become necessary. The panoramic view afforded from flying above it all was useful. Malloy could see everything. Cars were parked everywhere, and some trucks were close to the hospital. The police cars were visible from their flashing blue lights, and they had traffic pretty well stopped. And elsewhere the roads were clogged, at least those leading to the hospital. As usually happened, the roads leading away were wide open. A TV truck appeared, as though by magic, setting up half a mile or so from the hospital,
on the hilltop where some other vehicles were stopped, probably rubbernecking, the Marine thought. It always happened, like vultures circling a carcass at 29 palms. Very distasteful, and very human.
Popoff turned when he heard the white TV truck stop, not 10 meters from the rear bumper of his rented Jaguar. It had a satellite dish on the roof, and the vehicle had scarcely halted when men stepped out. One climbed the ladder affixed to the side and elevated the oddly angular dish. Another hoisted a minicam, and yet another, evidently the reporter, appeared, wearing a jacket and tie. He chatted briefly with one of the others, then turned, looking down the hill. Popoff ignored them.
Finally, Noonan said to himself, pulling off the road at the other cell site. He parked his car, got out, and reached for the keys the technician had given him. 3 minutes later, he uploaded his spoofing software. Then he donned his tactical radio set.
Noonan to Stanley, over.
This is Stanley.
Okay, Al, I just cut off the other cell. Cell phones ought to be down now for this entire area.
Very good, Tim.
Come this way now.
Roger, on the way.
The FBI agent adjusted the headset, hanging the microphone exactly in front of his mouth and pushing the earpiece all the way in as he re-entered his car and started off back toward the hospital.
Okay, you bastards, he thought. Try using your fucking phones now.
As usual in emergency situations, Popoff noted, you couldn't tell what was happening. At least 15 police vehicles were visible along with the 2 army trucks from the Hereford base. His binoculars didn't allow him to recognize any faces, but he'd seen only one of them close up, and that was the chief of the unit, and he'd be in some command post or other rather than visible in the open, assuming that he was here at all, the intelligence officer reminded himself. 2 men carrying long cases, probably riflemen, had walked away from the camouflage-painted trucks, but they were nowhere to be seen now, though... Yes, he saw, using his binoculars again. There was one, just a jump of green that hadn't been there before. How clever! He'd be a sniper using his telescopic sight to look into windows and gather information, which he'd then radio to his commander. There was another one of them around somewhere as well, but Popoff couldn't see him.
Rifle 1-2 to command, Fred Franklin called in.
1-2, this is command, Covington responded.
In position, sir, looking down, but I don't see anything at all in the windows on the ground level. Some movement of the curtains on the third floor like people peeking out, but nothing else.
Roger, thank you. Continue your surveillance.
Roger that. Rifle 1-2 out.
Several seconds later, Houston reported similar news. Both men were in perches, with their ghillie suits disguising their positions.
Finally, Covington said. A police car had just arrived, its occupant delivering blueprints of the hospital. Peter's gratitude died in a moment when he looked at the first 2 pages. There were scores of rooms, most of them on the upper levels, in any of which a man with a gun could hide and have to be winkled out. Worse, all of those rooms were probably occupied with real people, sick ones, whom a flash bang might startle enough to kill. Now that he had the knowledge, its only immediate benefit was to show him just how difficult his mission would be.
Sean?
Grady turned.
Yes, Roddy.
There they are, Sands pointed out. The black-clad soldiers were standing behind their army trucks, only a few meters from the trucks the Irishman had driven to the site.
I only count 6, lad, Grady said. We're hoping for 10 or so.
It is a poor time to become greedy, Sean.
Grady thought about that for a second, then checked his watch. He'd allotted 45 to 60 minutes for this mission. Any more, he thought, would give the other side too much time to get organized. They were within 10 minutes of the lower limit. So far, things had gone according to plan. Traffic would be blocked on the roads, but only into the hospital, not away from it. He had his 3 large trucks, the van,
and two private cars, all within 50 meters of where he was standing. The crucial part of the job was yet to begin, but his people all knew what to do. Roddy was right. It was time to wrap everything up and make his dash. Grady nodded at his subordinate, pulled out his cell phone, and hit the speed dial button for Timothy O'Neill. But it didn't work. Lifting the phone to his ear, all he heard was the fast, busy signal that announced that the call hadn't gone through properly. Annoyed, he thumbed end and redialed, and got the same result. "What's this?" he said, trying a third time. "Roddy, give me your phone." Sands offered it, and Grady took it. They were all identical in make, and all had been identically programmed. He thumbed the same speed dial command, and again got only the fast, busy response. More confused than angry, Grady nonetheless had a sudden empty feeling in his stomach. He'd planned for many things, but not for this. For the mission to work, he had to coordinate his three groups. They all knew what they were to do, but not when. Not until he told them that it was time.
"Bloody," Grady said quietly, rather to the surprise of Roddy Sands.
Next, Grady simply tried calling a mobile operator, but the same fast, busy signal resulted.
"The bloody phones have stopped working."
"We haven't heard from him in a while," Bellow observed.
"He hasn't given us a phone number yet."
"Try this." Tawny handed over a handwritten list of numbers in the hospital. Bellow selected the main ER number and dialed it on his cell phone, making sure to start with the 777 prefix. It rang for half a minute before it was picked up.
"Yes."
It was an Irish-sounding voice, but a different one.
"I need to talk to Mr. Casey," the psychiatrist said, putting the call on speaker.
"He's not here right now," was the reply. "Could you get him, please? I need to tell him something."
"Wait," the voice answered.
Bellow killed the microphone on the portable phone.
"Different voice. Not the same guy. Where's Casey?"
"Some other place in the hospital, I imagine," Stanley offered. But the answer was dissatisfying to him when no voice came back on the phone line for several minutes. Noonan had to explain who he was to two separate police checkpoints. But now the hospital was in sight. He called ahead on his radio, told Covington that he was 5 minutes away, and learned that nothing had changed. Clark and Chavez dismounted their vehicle 50 yards from the green trucks that had brought Team 1 to the site. Team 2 was now on its way, also in another green-painted British Army truck, with a police escort to speed their way through the traffic. Chavez was holding a collection of photographs of known PIRA terrorists that he'd snatched off the intelligence desk. The hard part, Ding found, was to keep his hands from shaking, whether from fear or rage he couldn't tell, and it required all the training he'd ever had to keep his mind on business rather than worrying about his wife and mother-in-law, and his unborn son. Only by looking down at the photos instead of up at the country was this possible. For in his hands he had faces to seek and kill. But the green grass around the hospital was merely empty landscape where there was danger. At times like this, the manly thing was to suck it in and pretend that you had it under control. But Chavez was learning now that while being brave for yourself was easy enough, facing danger to someone you loved was a very different situation. One in which courage didn't matter a damn, and all you could do was nothing. You were a spectator, and nothing more, watching a contest of sorts in which lives dear to you were at grave risk, but in which you could not participate. All he could do was watch, and trust to the professionalism of Covington's Team 1. One part of his mind told him that Peter and his boys were as good as he and his own people were, and that if a rescue could be done, they would surely do it. But that wasn't the same as being there yourself, taking charge, and making the right things happen yourself. Sometime later today, Chavez thought, he would again hold his wife in his arms. or she and their unborn child would be taken forever from him. His hands gripped the computer-generated photographs, bending the edges, and his only comfort was in the weight of the pistol that hung in the hip holster tucked into the waistband of his trousers. It was a familiar feeling, but one, his mind told him, which was useless at the moment, and likely to remain so.
"So, what do I call you?" Bello asked, when the phone line became active again.
"You can call me Timothy."
"Okay," the doctor said agreeably. "I'm Paul."
"You're an American," O'Neill observed.
"That's right."
"And so are the hostages you're holding, Dr. Chavez and Mrs. Clark."
"So?"
"So I thought your enemies were the Brits, not us Americans. You know that those two ladies are mother and daughter, don't you?"
He had to know it, Bello knew, and for that reason he could point it out as though giving away information.
"Yes," the voice replied.
"Did you know that they are both Catholic? Just like you?"
"No."
"Well, they are," Bello assured him. "You can ask. Mrs. Clark's maiden name is O'Toole, as a matter of fact. She is an Irish Catholic American citizen. What makes her your enemy, Timothy?"
"Well, she's... her husband is. I mean,
he's also an Irish Catholic American. And to the best of my knowledge, he has never taken action of any kind against you or the people in your organization. That's why I have trouble understanding why you are threatening their lives.
Her husband is the head of this Rainbow Mob, and they kill people for the British government."
"No, actually, they do not. Rainbow is actually a NATO establishment. The last time we went out, we had to rescue 30 children. I was there, too. The people holding them murdered one of the kids, a little Dutch girl named Anna. She was dying, Timothy. She had cancer, but those people weren't very patient about it. One of them shot her in the back and killed her. You've probably seen it on TV. Not the sort of thing a religious person would do. Not the sort of thing a Catholic would do, murdering a little girl like that. And Dr. Chavez is pregnant. I'm sure you can see that. If you harm her, what about her child? Not just a murder if you do that, Timothy. You're also aborting her unborn child. I know what the Catholic Church says about that. So do you. So does the government in the Republic of Ireland. Please, Timothy, will you please think about what you've threatened to do? These are real people, not abstractions. And the baby in Dr. Chavez's womb is also a real person, too.
Anyway, I have something to tell Mr. Casey. Have you found him yet? The psychiatrist asked.
No, he can't come to the phone now.
Okay, I have to go now. If I call this number again, will you be there to answer it?
Yes.
Good. I'll call back when I have some news for you. Bello punched the kill switch.
Good news. Different person. Younger. Not as sure of himself. I have something I can use on this one. He really is Catholic, or at least he thinks of himself that way. That means conscience and rules. I can work on this one, he concluded soberly, but with confidence.
But where is the other one? Stanley asked. Unless...
Huh? Tawny asked.
Unless he's not in there at all.
Huh? The doctor asked.
Unless he's not bloody there. He called us before, but he hasn't talked to us in quite a while. Shouldn't he be doing so?
Bello nodded.
I would have expected that, yes.
But Noonan has chopped the cell phones, Stanley pointed out.
He switched on his tactical radio.
Well, this is command. Look around for someone trying to use a cellular telephone. We may have two groups of subjects here. Acknowledge.
Command, this is Covington. Roger.
Fuck!
Malloy snarled in his circling helicopter.
Take her down some? Harrison asked.
The Marine shook his head. No, up here they might not even notice us. Let's stay covert for a while.
What the hell? Chavez observed, looking at his father-in-law.
Inside, outside, John speculated. Grady was at the point of losing his temper. He'd tried a total of 7 times to make a call with his cell phone, only to find the same infuriating, fast, busy response. He had a virtually perfect tactical situation, but lacked the ability to coordinate his teams. There they were, those rainbow people, standing in a bunch not 100 meters from the 2 Volvo trucks. This couldn't last, though. The local police would surely start securing the area soon. There were perhaps 150, perhaps as many as 200 people now, standing in little knots within 300 meters of the hospital. The time was right. The targets were there. Noonan crested the hill and started driving down to where the team was, wondering what the hell he'd be able to do. Bugging the building, his usual job, meant getting close. But it was broad daylight, and getting close would be a mother of a task, probably beyond the range of possibility until nightfall. Well, at least he'd taken care of his primary function. He denied the enemy the chance to use cell phones. If they'd tried to, which he didn't know. He slowed the car for his approach, and saw Peter Covington in the distance conferring with his black-clad shooters. Chavez and Clark were doing much the same thing, standing still a few yards from Clark's official car. "The perimeter needs firming up," Ding said. Where had all these vehicles come from? Probably people who happened to be in the area when the shooting started. There was the usual goddamned TV van, its satellite dish erected, and what appeared to be a reporter speaking in front of a handheld minicam. So, Chavez thought, now the danger to his family was a goddamned spectator sport. Grady had to make a decision, and he had to make it now. If he wanted to achieve his goal and make his escape, it had to be now. His gun-containing parcel was sitting on the ground next to his rental car. He left it on the ground with Roddy Sands and walked to the farthest of the Volvo commercial trucks.
"Sean," a voice called from the cargo area,
"the bloody phones don't work."
"I know. We begin in 5 minutes, watch for the others, and then carry on as planned."
"Okay, Sean," the voice replied.
To punctuate it, Grady heard the cocking of the weapons inside as he walked to the next, delivering the same message. Then the third. There were 3 men in each of the trucks. The canvas covers over the cargo areas had holes cut in them, like the battlements of a castle, and those inside had opened them slightly and were now looking at the soldiers less than 100 meters away. Grady made his way back to his Jaguar. When he got there, he checked his watch. He looked at Roddy Sands and nodded. Team 2's truck was starting down the hill to the hospital. Noonan's car was directly in front of it now. Popoff was watching the whole area with his binoculars. A 3rd military truck came into view. He looked at it and saw more men sitting in the back, probably reinforcements for the people already outside the hospital. He returned his attention to the area that already had soldiers. Closer examination showed. Was that John Clark, he wondered, standing away from the others? Well, if his wife were a hostage now, that made sense to let another. He had to have a second in command for his organization, command the operation. So he'd just be standing there now, looking tense in his suit.
"Excuse me."
Popoff turned to see a reporter and a cameraman, and closed his eyes in a silent curse.
"Yes?"
"Could you give us your impressions of what is happening here? First of all, your name, and what causes you to be here?"
"Well, my name is Jack Smith," Popoff said, in his best London accent. "And I was out here in the country, birding, you see. I was out here to enjoy nature. It's a nice day, you see, and—" "Mr. Smith, have you any idea what is happening down there?"
No, not really.
He didn't take his eyes away from the binoculars, not wanting to give them a look at his face.
Ничего.
There was Sean Grady, standing with Roddy Sands. Had he believed in God, he would have invoked his name at that moment, seeing what they were doing, and knowing exactly what they were thinking in this flashpoint in time.